this coming from? Maybe Mom should put her on a diet, I said. That way she won't be so fat. Actually, that's not a bad idea, my father said. My mother, newly pregnant and feeling somewhat chunky herself, put her 2 cents in, and I settled back, triumphant. This was the advantage of having a large family. You didn't want to focus attention on Lisa, Miss Perfect, but there were 3 and later 4 others to go after, all younger and all with their particular faults, buck teeth, failing grades. It was like shooting fish in a barrel. Even if I wound up getting punished, it was still a way of changing the channel, switching, in this case, from the Greg Show to the David Show, which was today sponsored by Gretchen's Weight Problem. Meanwhile, my sisters had their own channels to change, and when it got to be too much, when our parents could no longer take it, they'd open the car door and throw us out. The spot they favored, had actually blackened with their tire treads, was at the bottom of a steep hill. The distance home wasn't all that great, half a mile maybe, but it seemed twice as long when it was hot or raining or, worse yet, during a thunderstorm. "Ah, it's just heat lightning," our father would say. "That's not going to kill anybody. Now get the hell out of my car." Neighbors would pass, and when they honked, I'd remember that I was in my Speedo. Then I'd wrap a towel like a skirt around my waist and remind my sisters that this was not girlish, but Egyptian. Thank you very much. Drawing attention to Gretchen's weight was a sort of behavior my mother referred to as stirring the turd, and I did it a lot that summer. Dad wants Greg Sakis to be his son instead of me, I thought. And in response, I made myself the kind of kid that nobody could like. "What on earth has gotten into you?" my mother kept asking. I wanted to tell her, but more than that, I wanted her to notice it on her own. "How can you not?" I kept wondering. "It's all he ever talks about." The next swim meet was a replay of the first two. Coming home, I was once again in the way back. Anything to put some distance between me and my father. "I'll tell you what, that Greg is magic. Success is written all over his face, and when it happens, I'm going to say, 'Hey, buddy, remember me? I'm the one who first realized how special you are.'" He talked as if he actually knew stuff about swimming, like he was a talent scout for Poseidon or something. The butterfly's his strong suit, but let's not discount his crawl, or hell, even his breaststroke for that matter. Seeing that kid in the water is like seeing a shark. His talk was supposedly directed at my mother, who'd stare out the window and sometimes sigh, "Oh, gosh, Lou, I don't know." She never said anything to keep the conversation going, so I could only believe that he was saying these things for my benefit. Why else would he be speaking so loudly and catching my eye in the rearview mirror? One week while riding home, I took my sister Amy's Barbie doll, tied her feet to the end of my beach towel, and lowered her out the way back window, dragging her behind us as we drove along. Every so often, I'd reel her back in and look at the damage, the way the asphalt had worn the hair off one side of her head, whittled her ski-jump nose down to nothing. What, I wondered, was Greg up to at that exact moment? Did his father like him as much as mine did? He was an only child, so chances were he got the star treatment at home as well as at the club. I lowered the doll back out the window and let go of the towel. The car behind us honked, and I ducked down low and gave the driver the finger. By mid-July, I was begging to quit the team, but my parents wouldn't allow it. "Oh, you're a good swimmer," my mother said. "Not the best, maybe, but so what? Who wants to be the best at something you do in a bathing suit?" In the winter, my Greek grandmother was hit by a car and moved from New York State to live with us. Bringing her to the club would have depressed people. The gloomy black dresses, the long gray hair pinned into an old country bun. She was a human equivalent of a storm cloud. I thought she'd put a crimp in our upcoming pool schedule, but when Memorial Day arrived, it was business as usual. "She's a big girl," my mother said. "Let her stay home by herself." "Well, shouldn't we be back by 5, just in case she falls down the stairs or something?" I didn't want her to ruin my summer just to keep me off the swim team. I could come home and sit with her. "The hell you will," my mother said. "Nice steep fall is just what I'm hoping for." I thought the birth of my brother Paul might limit our pool hours as well, but again, no luck. It cannot have been healthy for a six-month-old in that hot sun. Maybe that's why he never cried. He was in shock, the only baby I'd ever seen with a tan line. "Cute kid," Greg said one afternoon, and I worried that he might win over Paul and my mother the way he had my father. The summer of 68 was even worse than the one before it. The club started serving a once-a-week prime rib dinner, dress-up, which meant my blue wool sport coat. Sweating over my fruit cocktail, I'd watch my father make his rounds, stopping at the Sackis' table and laying his hand on Greg's shoulder the way he'd never once put it on mine. There weren't many people I truly hated back then. 30, maybe 45 at most, and Greg was at the top of my list. The killer was that it wasn't even my idea. I was being forced to hate him, or rather, forced to hate myself for not being him. It's not as if the two of us were all that different, really. Same size, similar build. Greg wasn't exceptional looking. He was certainly no scholar. I was starting to see that he wasn't all that great a swimmer, either. Fast enough, sure, but far too choppy. I brought this to my father's attention, and he attributed my observation to sour grapes. "Maybe you should work on your own stroke before you start criticizing everyone else's." "Things will be better when the summer is over," I kept thinking. We continued going to the club for prime rib, but Greg wasn't always there, and without the swimming, there wasn't as much for my dad to carry on about. When fall arrived, he got behind a boy in my scout troop, but my father didn't really understand what went on in scouts. The most difficult thing we did that year was wrap potatoes in tinfoil, and I could wrap a potato just as well as the next guy. Then one night, while watching the Andy Williams show, he came upon Donny Osmond. "I just saw this kid on TV, and I mean to tell you, he absolutely knocked my socks off. The singing, the dancing, this boy's going to be huge, you mark my words." "You didn't discover him," I said the following evening at dinner. "If someone's on the Andy Williams show, it means they were already discovered. Stop trying to take credit." "Well, someone's testy, aren't they?" My father lifted his drink off the table. "I wonder when Donny will be on the show again." "It's the Osmond brothers," I said. "Girls at school talk about them all the time. It's not a solo act, they're a group." "Not without him, they're not. Donnie's the thunderbolt. Take him out of the picture and they're nothing." The next time they were on the Andy Williams show, my father flushed me out of my room and forced me to watch. "Isn't he fantastic? Just look at that kid. God almighty, can you believe it?" Competing against celebrities, people who were not in any sense real, was a losing game. I knew this as well as I knew my name and troop number, but the more my father carried on about Donny Osmond, the more threatened and insignificant I felt. The thing was that he didn't even like that kind of music. "Well, normally, no," he said when I brought it up. "Something about Donny, though, makes me like it." He paused. "And the hell of it is, he's even younger than you are." "A year younger? Well, that's still younger." I'd never know if my father did this to hurt me or to spur me on, but on both fronts he was wildly successful. I remember being at the club in the summer of 69, the day that men walked on the moon. Someone put a TV on the lifeguard chair and we all gathered around, me thinking that at least today something was bigger than Donny Osmond and Greg Sackis, who was actually now a little shorter than I was. That Labor Day, at the season's final intra-club meet, I beat Greg in the butterfly. "Were you watching? Did you see that? I won." "Maybe you did, but it was only by a hair," my father said on our way home that evening. "Besides, that was what, one time out of 50? I don't really see that you've got anything to brag about." That's when I thought, okay, so that's how it is. My dad was like the Marine Corps, only instead of tearing you to pieces and then putting you back together, he just did the first part and called it a day. Now it seems cruel, abusive even, but this all happened before the invention of self-esteem, which, frankly, I think is a little overrated. I'm sure my father said plenty of normal things to me when I was growing up, but what stuck, probably because he said it like 10,000 times, was, "Everything you touch turns to crap." His other catchphrase was, "You know what you are? A big, fat zero." "I'll show you," I remember thinking. Proving him wrong was what got me out of bed every morning. And when I failed, it's what got me back on my feet. I remember calling in the summer of 2008 to tell him my book was number one on the Times bestseller list. "Well, it's not number one on the Wall Street Journal list," he said. "That's not really the list that book people turn to," I told him. "The hell it isn't," he said. "I turn to it." "And you're a book person?" "I read, sure." I recalled the copy of Putt to Win gathering dust on the back seat of his car. "Of course you read," I said. "Number one on the Times list doesn't mean that your book is good, just that a lot of people bought it that week. People who were tricked, maybe, or were never too bright to begin with. It's not like winning the Nobel Prize in Literature, but still, if it's your kid, aren't you supposed to be happy and supportive? Of course, it complicates things when a lot of that book is about you and what a buffoon you can be. Number one in this particular case meant that a whole lot of people just read about my father sitting around in his underpants and hitting people over the head with spoons. So maybe he had a right to be less than enthusiastic. When I told him I'd started swimming again, my dad said, "Attaboy." This is a phrase he uses whenever I do something he thinks was his idea. "I'm going back to college. Attaboy. I'm thinking of getting my teeth fixed. Attaboy." On second thought, I always want to say, it's not my father's approval that troubles me, but my childlike hope that maybe this time it will last. He likes that I've started swimming again, so maybe he'll also like the house I bought. Boy, they sure saw you coming. Or the sport coat I picked up on my last trip to Japan. You look like a goddamn clown. Greg Sakis would have got the same treatment eventually, as would any of the other would-be sons my father pitted me against throughout my adolescence. Once I got used to the sweet taste of his approval, he'd have had no choice but to snatch it away. Not because of anything they did, but because it's in his nature. The guy sees a spark and just can't help but stomp it out. I was in Las Vegas not long ago and looked up to see Donny Osmond smiling down at me from a billboard only slightly smaller than the sky. "You," I whispered. In the hotel pool a few hours later, I thought of him as I swam my laps. Then I thought of Greg and was carried right back to the Raleigh Country Club. Labor Day, 1969. A big crowd for the intra-club meet, the air smelling of chlorine and smoke from the barbecue pit. The crummy part of swimming is that while you're doing it, you can't really see much. The bottom of the pool, certainly. A smudged and fleeting bit of the outside world as you turn your head to breathe. But you can't pick things out. A man's face, for example, watching from the sidelines when for the first time in your life you pull ahead and win. Think differenter. Of the many expressions we Americans tend to overuse, I think the most irritating is blind people are human too. They are, I guess, but saying so makes you sound preachy and involved, like all your best friends are blind, which they're probably not. I personally don't know any blind people, though the guy I used to buy my newspapers from had pretty bad cataracts. His left eye had a patch over it, and the right one reminded me of the sky in a werewolf movie. This pale blue moon obscured by drifting clouds. Still, though, he could see well enough to spot a Canadian quarter. "Oh, no, you don't," he said to me the last time I bought something. Then he actually grabbed my hand. I pulled it back. "Well, excuse me." Then I said, "I think it's about time I take my business elsewhere." Normally I say about, but I wanted him to think that I was Canadian, which could have been true if I were born a couple hundred miles to the north. Son of a bitch, half-blind person. I'm through defending the likes of him. Number two on my irritating expression list is, I'll never forget the time, ... People say this to me and I think, yawn, am I ever in for a boring story? Take this 4th of July party, the one thrown every year at the apartment complex I live at. I went last summer and it was me, this guy Teddy from two doors down, and a woman from the ground floor, all standing around the pool. The fireworks had ended, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, Teddy looks down into the water. I'll never forget the time my 5-year-old daughter drowned, he told us, all mournful, as if it had happened that week and not an entire year ago. The woman from the ground floor put her hand on his shoulder. Oh my God, she said, that is the saddest thing I ever heard in my life. I, meanwhile, was standing there thinking that you should never say never, especially in regard to what you'll remember. People get older and you'd be surprised by what they forget. Like, for example, a few weeks back, I called my mother to wish her a happy birthday, her 80th. I bet you wish that Dad was still alive, I said. That way the two of you could celebrate together. But he is still alive, she told me. He is? Well, of course, she said. Who do you think answered the phone? Here I am, just turned 50, and I forgot that my father isn't dead yet. In my defense, though, he's pretty close to it. Healthy enough for the moment, but he doesn't do any of the stuff he used to do, like give me money or teach me to ride bikes. There are things you forget naturally, computer passwords, your father's continuing relationship with life. And then there are things you can't forget but wish you could. Once, for instance, when I was in the 3rd grade, I saw our dog Pepper chew the head off a baby rabbit. I mean right off, too, the way I'd pop the lid from an aspirin bottle. That I can recall just like it was yesterday, while my first child being born, total blank. I know I was in the delivery room. I can even remember what I was listening to on my Walkman. But as for the actual kid coming out, nothing. I can't even tell you if it was a boy or a girl, but that's natural for a first marriage. The Walkman, though, I'll never forget its weight and the way it fit into my jacket pocket. Now, of course, it would be like carrying around a brick, but at the time it was hard to imagine anything more modern. When the first iPod came out, I recall thinking that it would never last. Isn't that funny? It's what old kooks thought when the car was invented, only now the kook was me. I held on to my Walkman until the iPod Shuffle was introduced, at which point I caved in and bought one. I got remarried as well, but it only lasted until the iPod Nano, which the child from that marriage, a boy, I'm pretty sure, threw into the toilet along with my wallet and my car keys. Instead of fishing it all out and getting my hands dirty, I left that wife and kid and moved to where I live now, the apartment complex I mentioned earlier. I thought of replacing my Nano, but instead I waited a while and got an iPhone, which I specifically use not to call either of my ex-wives or the children they tricked me into having. It's a strain on the eyes, but I also read the paper on it, so take that, news agent. I'm the half-blind one now, and you're out of a job. The iPhone 2 led to the 3, but I didn't get the 4 or 5 because I'm holding out for the 7, which I've heard on good authority can also be used as a taser. This will mean I'll have just one less thing to carry around. And isn't that technology's job, to lighten our burden, to broaden our horizons, to make it possible to talk to your attorney and listen to a Styx album and check the obituaries in the town where your parents continue to live and videotape a race riot and send a text message and stun someone into submission all at the same time? Doing it all while driving is illegal where I live, so I'm moving to a place where freedom still means something. I'm not telling you where it is because I want it to remain unspoiled. I'll just say it's one of the few states left where the mentally ill can legally own firearms. They used to be limited to muskets, but now they can carry or conceal everything a normal person can. If you don't think that a mental patient has the right to bring a sawed-off shotgun to the church where his ex-girlfriend is getting married, you're part of the problem. The truth is that crazy people, who are really just regular people but more misunderstood, have as much of a right to protect themselves as we do. Live with liberty and your imagination can soar. If I had been born in the state I'm moving to, there's no telling who I might be by now. an oral surgeon, maybe, or perhaps the ruler of the whole U.S. countryside. Other kings would pay me tribute with livestock and precious gems, but deep inside, I don't think I'd be any different from who I am today. Just a guy with a phone, waiting for the day when he can buy an even better one. Loggerheads. The thing about Hawaii, at least the part that is geared towards tourists, is that it's exactly what it promises to be. Step off the plane and someone places a lei around your neck, as if it were something you had earned, an Olympic medal for sitting on your ass. Raise a hand above your shoulder, and no matter where you are, a drink will appear, something served in a hollowed-out pineapple, or perhaps in a coconut that's been sawed in half. Just like in the time before glasses, you think. Volcanic craters, waterfalls, and those immaculate beaches. Shocking things when you're coming from Europe. At the spot Hugh and I go to in Normandy, you'll find, in place of sand, speckled stones the size of potatoes. The water runs from glacial to heart attack and is tinted the color of iced tea. Then there's all the stuff floating in it, not man-made garbage, but sea garbage. Scum and bits of plant life, all of it murky and rotten smelling. The beaches in Hawaii look as if they've been bleached. That's how white the sand is. The water is warm, even in winter. It's so clear you can see not just your toes, but the corns cleaving, barnacle-like, to the sides of them. On Maui one November, Hugh and I went swimming and turned to find a gigantic sea turtle coming up between us. As gentle as a cow she was, and with a cow's dopey, almost lovesick expression on her face. That, to me, was worth the entire trip, worth my entire life, practically. For to witness majesty, to find yourself literally touched by it, isn't that what we've all been waiting for? I had a similar experience a few years later, and again with Hugh. We were in Japan, walking through a national forest in a snowstorm, when a monkey the height of a barstool brushed against us. His fur was a dull silver, the color of dishwater, but he had this beet-red face, set in a serious, almost solemn expression. We saw it full-on when he turned to briefly look at us, then he shrugged and ambled off over a footbridge. "Jesus Christ," I said, because it was all too much, the forest, the snowstorm, and now this. Monkeys are an attraction in that part of the country. We expected to see them at some point, but I thought they'd be fenced in. As with the sea turtle, part of the thrill was a feeling of being accepted, which is to say, not feared. It allowed you to think that you and this creature had a special relationship, a juvenile thought, but one that brings with it a definite comfort. "Well, monkeys like me," I'd find myself thinking during the next few months whenever I felt lonely or unappreciated. Just as in the months following our trip to Hawaii, I thought of the sea turtle. With her, though, my feelings were a bit more complicated. And instead of believing that we had bonded, I'd wonder that she could ever have forgiven me. The thing between me and sea turtles started in the late 60s and involved my best friend from grade school, a boy I'll call Sean, who lived down the street from me in Raleigh. What brought us together was a love of nature, or more specifically, of catching things and unintentionally killing them. We started when I was in the fourth grade, which would have made me 10, I guess. It's different for everyone, but at that age, though I couldn't have said that I was gay, I knew that I was not like the other boys in my class or scout troop. While they welcomed male company, I shrank from it, dreaded it, feeling like someone forever trying to pass, someone who would eventually be found out and expelled from polite society. "Is this how a normal boy would swing his arms?" I'd ask myself, standing before the full-length mirror in my parents' bedroom. "Is this how he'd laugh? Is this what he would find funny?" It was like doing an English accent. The more concentrated the attempt, the more self-conscious and unconvincing I became. With Sean, though, I could almost be myself. This didn't mean that we were alike, only that he wasn't paying that much attention. Childhood, for him, seemed something to be endured, passed through like a tiresome stretch of road. Ahead of this was the good stuff. And looking at him from time to time, at the way he had of staring off, of boring a hole into the horizon. You got the sense that he could not only imagine it, but actually see it, this great grown-up life, waiting on the other side of 16. Apart from an interest in wildlife, the two of us shared an identity as transplants. My family was from the North, and the Taylors were from the Midwest. Sean's father, Hank, was a psychiatrist and sometimes gave his boys and me tests, the type for which there were, he assured us, no right answers. He and his wife were younger than my parents, and they seemed it, not just in their dress, but in their eclectic tastes, records by Donovan and Moby Grape, shelved among the Schubert. Their house had real hardcover books in it, and you often saw them lying open on the sofa, the words still warm from being read. In a neighborhood of stay-at-home moms, Sean's mother worked. A public health nurse, she was the one you went to if you woke up with yellow eyes or jammed a piece of caramel corn too far into your ear. "Oh, you're fine," Jean would say, for that was what she wanted us to call her, not Mrs. Taylor. With her high cheekbones and ever so slightly turned down mouth, she brought to mind a young Katharine Hepburn. Other mothers might be pretty, might in their 20s or early 30s pause at beauty, but Jean was clearly parked there for a lifetime. You'd see her in her flower bed, gardening gloves hanging from the waistband of her slacks like someone clawing to get out, and you just had to wish that she was your mom instead. The Taylor children had inherited their mother's good looks, especially Sean. Even as a kid, he seemed at home in his skin, never cute, just handsome, blonde hair like a curtain drawn over half his face. The eye that looked out the uncurtained side was cornflower blue and excelled at spotting wounded or vulnerable animals. While the other boys in our neighborhood played touch football in the street, Sean and I searched the woods behind our houses. I drew the line at snakes, but anything else was brought home and imprisoned in our 10-gallon aquariums. Lizards, toads, baby birds, they all got the same diet, raw hamburger meat. And with few exceptions, they all died within a week or two. "Menu-wise, it might not hurt you to branch out a little," my mother once said in reference to my captive Luna moth. It was the size of a paperback novel, a beautiful mint green, but not much interested in ground chuck. "Maybe you could feed it some, I don't know, flowers or something." Like she knew. The best-caught creature belonged to Sean's younger brother, Chris, who'd found an injured flying squirrel and kept him uncaged in his bedroom. The thing was no bigger than an ordinary hamster, and when he glided from the top bunk to the dresser, his body flattened out, making him look like an empty hand puppet. The only problem was the squirrel's disposition, his one-track mind. You wanted him to cuddle or ride sentry on your shoulder, but he refused to relax. "I've got to get out of here," you could sense him thinking, as he clawed desperate and wild-eyed at the windowpane, or tried to squeeze himself underneath the door. He made it out eventually, and though we all hoped he'd return for meals, become a kind of part-time pet, he never did. Not long after the squirrel broke free, Jean took her boys and me for a weekend on the North Carolina coast. It was mid-October, the start of the sixth grade, and the water was too chilly to swim in. On the Sunday we were to head back home, Sean and I got up at dawn and took a walk with our nets. We were hunting for ghost crabs when in the distance we made out these creatures moving blockily, like wind-up toys on an unsteady surface. On closer inspection, we saw that they were baby sea turtles, dozens of them, digging out from under the sand and stumbling toward the ocean. An adult might have carried them into the surf or held at bay the predatory gulls, but we were 12. So while I scooped the baby turtles into a pile, Sean ran back and got the trash cans from our hotel room. We might have walked off with the whole lot, but they seemed pretty miserable, jumbled atop one another. Thus, in the end, we took just 10, which meant 5 apiece. The great thing about sea turtles, as opposed to, say, flying squirrels, was that they would grow exponentially, meaning what, 50, 100 times their original size? When we got them, each called to mind a plastic coin purse, the oval sort handed out by banks and car dealerships. Then there were their flippers and, of course, their heads, which were bald and beaky, like a newly hatched bird's. Since the death of a traumatized mole pried from the mouth of our cat, Samantha, my aquarium had sat empty and was therefore ready for some new tenants. I filled it with a jug of ocean water I'd brought back from the beach, then threw in a conch shell and a couple of sand dollars to make it more homey. The turtles swam the short distance from one end of the tank to the other, and then they batted at the glass with their flippers, unable to understand that this was it, the end of the road. What they needed, it seemed, was something to eat. "Mom, do we have any raw hamburger?" Looking back, you'd think that someone would have said something. Sea turtles, for God's sake. But maybe they weren't endangered yet. Animal cruelty hadn't been invented either. The thought that a non-human being had physical feelings, let alone the wherewithal to lose hope, was outlandish and alien, like thinking that paper had relatives. Then, too, when it comes to eliciting empathy, it's the back of the line for reptiles and amphibians, creatures with, face it, not much in the way of a personality. Even giving them names didn't help, as playing with Shelley was no different from playing with Pocahontas. Playing, in this case, amounting to placing them on my desk and watching them toddle over the edge. It was good to know that in the house down the street, Sean's turtles weren't faring much better. The hamburger meat we'd put in our aquariums went uneaten, and within a short time it spoiled and started stinking up our rooms. I emptied my tank, and in the absence of more seawater, I made my own with plain old tap water and salt. "I'm not sure that that's going to work," my mother said. She was standing in my doorway with a cigarette in one hand and an ashtray in the other. Recent experiments with a home frosting kit had dried out and broken her already brittle hair. What was left, she'd covered with a scarf, a turquoise one that looked great when she had a tan, but not so great when she didn't. "Doesn't ocean water have nutrients in it or something?" "I don't know." She looked at the turtles, unhappily dragging themselves across my bedspread. "Well, if you want to find out, I'm taking Lisa to the library this Saturday." I'd hoped to spend my weekend outside, but then it rained and my father hogged the TV for one of his football games. It was either go to the library or stay home and die of boredom, so I got into the car, groaning at the unfairness of it all. My mother dropped my sister and me downtown, and then she went to do some shopping, promising to return in a few hours. It wasn't much to look at, our public library. I'd later learned that it used to be a department store, which made sense. The floor-to-ceiling windows were right for mannequins, and you could easily imagine dress shirts where the encyclopedias were, wigs in place of the magazines. I remember that in the basement there were two restrooms, one marked men and the other marked gentlemen. Inside each was a toilet, a sink, and a paper towel dispenser, meaning that whichever you chose, you got pretty much the same treatment. Thus, it came down to how you saw yourself, as regular or fancy. On the day I went to research turtles, I saw myself as fancy, so I opened the door marked gentleman. What happened next happened very quickly. Two men, both of them black, turned their heads in my direction. One was standing with his pants and underwear pulled down past his knees, and as he bent to yank them up, the other man, who'd been kneeling before him and who also had his pants lowered, covered his face with his hand and let out a little cry. "Oh," I told them, "I'm sorry." I backed shaken out of the room, and just as the door had closed behind me, it swung open again. Then the pair spilled out, that flying squirrel look in their eyes. The stairs were at the end of a short hall, and they took them two at a time, the slower man turning his head just briefly and looking at me as if I held a gun. When I saw that he was afraid of me, I felt powerful. Then I wondered how I might use that power. My first instinct was to tell on them, not because I wanted the two punished, but because I would have liked the attention. "Are you all right?" the librarian would have asked. "And these were Negroes, you say? Quick, somebody, get this young man a glass of water, or better yet, a Coke. Would you like a Coke while we wait for the police?" And in my feeblest voice, I would have said, "Yes." Then again, it could so easily backfire. The men were doing something indecent, and recognizing it as such meant that I had an eye for it, that I, too, was suspect. And wasn't I? In the end, I told no one, not even Lisa. "So did you find out what kind of turtles they are?" my mother asked as we climbed back into the car. Sea turtles, I told her. Well, we know that. No, I mean, that's what they're called, sea turtles. And what do they eat? I looked out the rain-streaked window. Hamburger? My mother sighed. Have it your way. It took a few weeks for my first turtle to die. The water in the tank had again grown murky with spoiled, uneaten beef, but there was something else as well, something I couldn't begin to identify. The smell that developed in the days after Halloween, this deep, swampy funk, was enough to make your eyes water. It was as if the turtles' very souls were rotting. Yet still they gathered in the corner of their tank, determined to find the sea. At night I would hear their flippers against the glass and think about the Negroes in the gentleman's room, wondering what would become of them. What, by extension, would become of me? Would I too have to live on the run, afraid of even a 12-year-old? One Friday in early November, my father paid a rare visit to my room. In his hand was a glass of gin, his standard after-work cocktail, mixed with a little water and garnished with a lemon peel. I liked the drink's medicinal smell, but today it was overpowered by the aquarium. He regarded it briefly and, wincing at the stench, removed two tickets from his jacket pocket. "They're for a game," he told me. "A game?" "Football," he said. "I thought we could go tomorrow afternoon." "But tomorrow I have to write a report." "Write it on Sunday." I'd never expressed any interest in football. Never played it with the kids on the street, never watched it on TV, never touched the helmet I'd received the previous Christmas. "Why not take Lisa?" I asked. "Because you're my son, that's why." I looked at the Holocaust taking place in my aquarium. "Do I have to?" If I were to go to a game today, I'd certainly find something to enjoy, the food, the noise, the fans marked up with paint. It would be an experience. At the time, though, it threw me into a panic. "Which team am I supposed to care about?" I asked myself as we settled into our seats. "How should I react if someone scores a point?" The thing about sports, at least for guys, is that nobody ever defines the rules, not even in gym class. Asking what a penalty means is like asking who Jesus was. It's one of those things you're just supposed to know, and if you don't, there's something seriously wrong with you. Two of the popular boys from my school were standing against a railing a few rows ahead of us, and when I stupidly pointed them out to my father, he told me to go over and say hello. How to explain that looking at them, even from this distance, was pushing it? Addressing them, it followed, was completely out of the question. People had their places, and to not understand that, to act in violation of it, demoted you from a nature knot to something even lower, a complete untouchable, basically. "That's all right," I said. "They don't really know who I am." "Ah, baloney. Go over and talk to them." "No, really. Do you want me to drag you over there?" As I dug in, I thought of the turtles. All they'd ever wanted was to live in the ocean. That was it, their entire wish list. And instead, I decided they'd be better off in my bedroom. Just as my dad had decided I'd be better off at the football game. If I could have returned them to the beach, I would have, though I knew it was already too late. In another few days, they would start going blind. Then their shells would soften, and they'd just sort of melt away, like soap. "Are you going over there or aren't you?" my dad asked. When the last turtle died and was pitched into the woods behind my house, Sean and I took up bowling, the only sport I was ever half decent at. The Western Lanes was a good distance away, and when our parents wouldn't drive us, we rode our bikes, me with a transistor radio attached by rubber bands to my handlebars. We were just thinking of buying our own bowling shoes when Sean's mother and father separated. Hank took an apartment in one of the new complexes, and a few months later, not yet 40 years old, he died. "Died of what?" I asked. "His heart stopped beating," was the answer Sean gave me. "Well, sure," I said, "but doesn't every dead person's heart stop beating? There must have been something else going on." "His heart stopped beating." Following the funeral, there was a reception at the Taylor's house. Sean and I spent most of it on the deck off his living room, him firing his BB gun into the woods with that telescopic look in his eye. After informing me that his father's heart had stopped beating, he never said another word about it. I never saw Sean cry or buckle at the knees or do any of the things that I would have done. Drama-wise, it was a chance of a lifetime, but he wasn't having any of it. From the living room, I could hear my father talking to Jean. What with Hank gone, the boys are going to need a positive male influence in their lives, he said. That being the case, I'd be happy to ignore them, my mother cut in, just like he does with his own damn kids. And Jean laughed. Oh, Sharon. 18 years passed before I learned what had really happened to Sean's father. By then, I was living in Chicago. My parents were still in Raleigh, and several times a week, I talked to my mother on the phone. I don't remember how the subject came up, but after she told me, I was stunned. Did Sean know? I asked. I'm sure he did, my mother said. And although I hadn't seen or spoken to him since high school, I couldn't help but feel a little betrayed. If you can't tell your best friend that your dad essentially drank himself to death, who can you tell? It's a lot to hold in at that age, but then I guess we all had our secrets. It was after talking to my mom on the phone that I finally went to the library and looked up those turtles. Loggerheads is what they were called. When mature, they can measure 3.5 feet long. A female might reach 400 pounds, and of all the eggs she lays in a lifetime, only 1 in 1,000 will make it to adulthood. Pretty slim odds when by making it, you mean simply surviving. Before the reception ended that day, Sean handed his BB gun to me. My father was watching from the living room window and interceded just as I raised it to my shoulder. Oh, no, you don't. You're going to put somebody's eye out. Somebody like a bird, I said. I'm just firing into the woods, not into the house. I don't give a damn where you're aiming. I handed the rifle back to Sean, and as he brushed the hair from his eyes and peered down the scope, I tried to see what I imagined he did. A life on the other side of this. Something better, perhaps even majestic, waiting for us to grow into it. If I ruled the world.
If I ruled the world, the first thing I'd do is concede all power to the real king, who, in case you don't happen to know, is named Jesus Christ. A lot of people have managed to forget this lately, so the second thing I'd do is remind them of it. Not only would I bring back mandatory prayer in school, I'd also institute it at work, then in skating rinks and in airports. Wherever people live or do business, they shall know his name. Christ's picture will go on all our money, and if you've had your check specially printed with sailboats or shamrocks on them, well, too bad for you, because from here on out, the only images allowed will be of him or maybe of me reminding you of how important he is. T-shirts with crosses and apostles on them will be allowed, but none of this nonsense you see nowadays. This one my neighbor has, for example, certified sex instructor, it says. He claims he only wears it while mowing the lawn, but in the summer that's once a week, which in my book is once a week too often. I mean, please, he's 72. Jesus and I are going to take that T-shirt and all the ones like it and use them as rags for washing people's mouths out. I normally don't believe in rough stuff, but what about those who simply refuse to learn? Look, I'll say to Jesus, enough is enough. I say we nail some boards together and have ourselves an old-fashioned crucifixion. It's bound to stir up a few bad memories. But having been gone all that time, he probably won't know how bad things have gotten. Just turn on the radio, I'll tell him. It's that thing next to my ferret cage with all the knobs on it. Jesus will tune in to our local so-called music station, and within 2 minutes he'll know what I'm talking about. Music's so rude it'll make his ears blister. And the TV. I turned mine on the other morning and came upon a man who used to be a woman. Had a little mustache, a pot belly and everything. changed her name from Mary Louise to Carl, and sat back with a satisfied smile on her face, figuring she'd licked the system. And maybe she did last year when they did the operation, but Jesus is a system now, and we'll just hear what he has to say about it. The creature on TV, I can't say male or female without bringing on a stomach ache, said that when it was a woman, it was attracted to men, and that it still is. This means that now, on top of everything else, it's a homosexual. As if we didn't have enough already, some doctor had to go and make one. Well, to hell with him, quite literally. And to hell with all the other gays, too. And the abortionists and the people who have had abortions, even if they were raped or the baby had three heads and delivering it was going to tear the mother to pieces. That was your baby, I'm going to say to Jesus. Now, you're just going to sit back and watch while it gets thrown onto some trash heap? And Jesus will say, no, Cassie Hasselbeck, I am not. He and I are going to work really well together. What's next on the agenda, he'll ask, and I'll point him to the Muslims and vegans who think their God is the real one. The same goes for the Buddhists and whoever it is that thinks that cows and monkeys have special powers. Then we'll move on to the comedians with their F this and GD that. I'll crucify the Democrats, the communists, and a good 97% of the college students. Don't you laugh, Tim Cobblestone, because you're next. Think you can let your cat foul my flower bed and get away with it? Well, think again. And Curtis Devlin, who turned down my application for a home improvement loan, and Carlotta Buffington, who only got that job because she's paralyzed on one half of her body. And even my grandson, Kenyon Bullock. He just turned 5, but no matter what Tricia says, this is not a phase. The child is evil. And it's best to stop him now before any real damage is done. And all the other evil people and whores and liars who want to take away our freedom or raise my taxes, they shall know our fury, Jesus's and mine, and burn forever.
The following is a bit from Pimsleur's Japanese One.
Ask the woman, do you understand English?
英語がわかりますか?
How does she answer? No.
いいえ?
Easy, tiger. On a recent flight from Tokyo to Beijing, at around the time that my lunch tray was taken away, I remembered that I needed to learn Mandarin. God damn it, I whispered. I knew I forgot something. Normally, when landing in a foreign country, I'm prepared to say, at the very least, hello and I'm sorry. This trip, though, was a two-parter, and I'd used my month of prep time to bone up on my Japanese. For this, I returned to the Pimsleur audio program I'd relied on from my previous two visits. I'd used its Italian version as well, and had noted that they followed the same basic pattern. In the first 30-minute lesson, a man approaches a strange woman, asking in Italian or Japanese or whichever language you've signed up for if she understands English. The two jabber away for 20 seconds or so, and then an American instructor chimes in and breaks it all down. Say, excuse me, he tells you. Ask, are you an American? The conversations grow more complicated as you progress, and the phrases are regularly repeated so that you don't forget them. Not all the sentences I've learned with Pimsleur are suited to my way of life. I don't drive, for example, so which is the road to go to Yokohama never did me any good. The same is true for, as for gas, is it expensive? Though I have gotten some mileage out of fill her up, please, which I use in restaurants when getting a second cup of tea. Thanks to Japanese 1 and 2, I'm able to buy train tickets, count to 999,000, and say whenever someone is giving me change, now you are giving me change. I can manage in a restaurant, take a cab, and even make small talk with the driver. Do you have children? I ask. Will you take a vacation this year? Where to? When he turns it around, as Japanese cab drivers are inclined to do, I tell him that I have 3 children, a big boy and 2 little girls. If Pimsleur included, I am a middle-aged homosexual and thus make do with a niece I never see and a very small godson, I'd say that. In the meantime, I work with what I have. Pimsleur is a big help when it comes to pronunciation. The actors are native speakers, and they don't slow down for your benefit. The drawbacks are that they never explain anything or teach you to think for yourself. Instead of being provided with building blocks that would allow you to construct a sentence of your own, you're left with using the hundreds or thousands of sentences that you have memorized. This means waiting for a particular situation to arise in order to comment on it. Either that or becoming one of those weird non sequitur people, the kind who, when asked a question about paint color, answer, "There is a bank in front of the train station," or, "Mrs. Yamada Ito has been playing tennis for 15 years. I hadn't downloaded a Pimsleur program for China, so on the flight to Beijing, I turned to my Lonely Planet phrasebook, knowing it was hopeless. Mandarin is closer to singing than it is to talking, and even though the words were written phonetically, I couldn't begin to get the hang of them. The book was slim and palm-sized, divided into short chapters: banking, shopping, border crossing. The one titled Romance included the following. "Would you like a drink? You're a fantastic dancer. You look like some cousin of mine." The latter would work only if you were Asian, but even then it's a little creepy, the implication being the cousin I have always wanted to undress and ejaculate on. In the subchapter, Getting Closer, one learns to say, "I like you very much. You're great. Do you want a massage?" On the following page, things heat up. "I want you. I want to make love to you. How about going to bed?" And a line that might have been written especially for me, "Don't worry, I'll do it myself." Oddly, the writers haven't included "leave the light on," a must if you want to actually say any of these things. One pictures the vacationer naked on a bed and squinting into his or her little book to moan, "Oh yeah, easy tiger, faster, harder, slower, softer, that was amazing, weird, wild, can I stay over?" In the following subchapter, it all falls apart. "Are you seeing someone else? He/she is just a friend. You're just using me for sex. I don't think it's working out." And finally, "I never want to see you again." Hugh and I returned from China, and a few days later I started preparing for a trip to Germany. The first time I went in 1999, I couldn't bring myself to say so much as Guten Morgen. The sounds felt false coming out of my mouth, so instead I spent my time speaking English apologetically. Not that the apologies were needed. In Paris, yes, but in Berlin, people's attitude is, "Thank you for allowing me to practice my perfect English." And I do mean perfect. "Are you from Minnesota?" I kept asking. In the beginning, I was put off by the harshness of German. Someone would order a piece of cake, and it sounded as if it were an actual order, like, "Cut the cake and lie face down in that ditch between the cobbler and the little girl." I'm guessing this comes from having watched too many Second World War movies. Then I remembered the umpteen Fassbinder films I sat through in the 80s, and German began to sound conflicted instead of heartless. I went back twice in 2000, and over time the language grew on me. It's like English, but sideways. I've made at least 10 separate trips by now, and have gone from one end of the country to the other. People taught me all sorts of words, but the only ones that stuck were Kaiserschnitt, which means cesarean section, and Lebenabschnittspartner. This doesn't translate to lover or life partner, but rather to the person I am with today, the implication being that things change and you are keeping yourself open. For this latest trip, I wanted to do better, so I downloaded all 30 lessons of Pimsleur German 1. which again start off with, "Excuse me, do you understand English?" As with the Japanese and the Italian versions, the program taught me to count and to tell time. Again, I learned, "The girl is already big," and "How are you?" Wie geht es Ihnen? In Japanese and Italian, the response to the final question is, "I'm fine, and you?" In German, it's answered with a sigh and a slight pause, followed by, "Not so good." I mentioned this to my German friend Thilo, who said that of course that was the response. "We can't get it through our heads that people are asking that only to be polite," he said. In Japanese 1, Lesson 17, the actress who plays the wife says, "Kaimono ga shitai desu ne. I want to go shopping, but there's a problem and you need to guess what it is." The exercise is about numbers, so the husband asks how much money she has. She gives him a figure and he offers to increase it incrementally. Similarly, in the German version, the wife announces that she wants to buy something. "Ich möchte noch etwas kaufen." Her husband asks how much money she has, and after she answers, he responds coldly, "I'm not giving you any more. You have enough." There's no discord in Pimsleur's Japan, but its Germany is a moody and often savage place. In one of the exercises, you're encouraged to argue with a bellhop who tries to cheat you out of your change and who ends up sneering, "You don't understand German." "Oh, but I do," you learn to say. "I do understand German." It's a program full of odd sentence combinations. "We don't live here, we want mineral water," implies that if the couple did live in this particular town, they'd be getting drunk just like everyone else. Another standout is, "Der Wein ist zu teuer und Sie sprechen zu schnell." The wine is too expensive and you talk too fast. The response to this would be, "Anything else, Herr asshole." But of course, they don't teach you that. On our last trip to Tokyo, Hugh and I rented an apartment in a nondescript neighborhood a few subway stops from Shinjuku Station. A representative from the real estate agency met us at the front door, and when I spoke to him in Japanese, he told me I needed to buy myself some manga. "Read those and you'll learn how people actually talk," he said. You're a little too polite." I know what he was getting at, but I really don't see this as much of a problem, especially if you're a foreigner, and any perceived rudeness can turn someone not just against you, but against your entire country. Here, Pimsleur has it all over the phrase books of my youth, where the ugly American was still alive and kicking people. "I didn't order this," he raged in Greek and Spanish. "Think you can cheat me, do you? Go away or I'll call the police." Now for the traveling American, there's less of a need for phrase books. Not only do we expect everyone to speak our language, we expect everyone to be fluent. I rarely hear an American vacationer say to a waiter or a shopkeeper in Europe, "Your English is so good." Rather, we act as if it were part of his job, like carrying a tray or making change. In this respect, the phrase books and audio programs are an almost charming throwback, a suggestion that the traveler put himself out there, that he opened himself to criticism, and not the person who's just trying to scrape by selling meatballs in Bumfuckio, Italy. One of the things I like about Tokyo is the constant reinforcement one gets for trying. "You are very skilled at Japanese," everyone keeps telling me. I know people are just being polite, but it spurs me on, just as I hope to be spurred on in Germany. To this end, I've added a second audio program, one by a man named Michel Thomas, who works with a couple of students, a male and a female. At the start, he explains that German and English are closely related, and thus have a lot in common. In one language, the verb is to come, and in the other, it's kommen. English to give is German geben. Boston's that is good is Berlin's das ist gut. It's an excellent way to start and leaves the listener thinking, "Hey, I can do this." Unlike the nameless instructor in Pimsleur, Herr Thomas explains things. The fact, for example, that if there are two verbs in a German sentence, one of them comes at the end. He doesn't give you phrases to memorize. In fact, he actively discourages study. "How would you say, give it to me?" he asks the female student. she and I correctly answer, and then he turns to the mail. Now try, I would like for you to give it to me. 10 minutes later, we've graduated to, I can't give it to you today because I cannot find it. To people who speak nothing but English, this might seem easy enough, but anyone else will appreciate how difficult it is. Negatives, multiple uses of it, and the hell that breaks loose following the German because. The thrill is that you're actually figuring it out on your own. You're engaging with another language, not just parroting it. Walking through the grocery store with Pimsleur und Thomas on my iPod, I picture myself pulling up to my Munich hotel with my friend Ulrika, who's only ever known me to say cesarean section and the person I am with until someone better comes along. Bleiben wir hier heute Abend, I plan to say. Wie viel Nächte? Zwei? Das ist teuer, nicht wahr? She's a wonderful woman, Ulrika, and if that's all I get out of this, seeing the shock register on her face as I natter on, it'll be well worth my month of study. Perhaps that evening after dinner I'll turn on the TV in my hotel room, and maybe, if I'm lucky, I'll understand one out of every 200 words. The trick, ultimately, is to not let that discourage me, to think, oh, well, that's more than I understood the last time I watched TV in Germany. That was a few years back in Stuttgart. There was a television mounted on a perch in my room, and I turned it on to find a couple having sex. This wasn't on pay-per-view, but just regular Sunday night TV. And I mean these two were really going at it. If I'd had the Lonely Planet guide to German, I might have recognized, please don't stop. That was amazing. Weird. With Herr Thomas, I could understand, I just gave it to you. And with Pimsleur, I would like to come now. I watched this couple for a minute or two, and then I advanced to the next channel, which was snowed out unless you paid for it. What could they possibly be doing here that they weren't doing for free on the other station, I asked myself. Turning each other inside out? And isn't that the joy of foreign travel? There's always something to scratch your head over. You don't have to be fluent in order to wonder. Rather, you can sit there with your mouth open, not exactly dumb, just speechless.
This is something called Laugh Kookaburra. I've been to Australia twice so far, but according to my father, I've never actually seen it. He made this observation at the home of my cousin Joan, whom he and I visited just before Christmas, and it came on the heels of another equally aggressive comment. Well, he said, David's a better reader than he is a writer. This from someone who hasn't opened a book since 1996's Dave Stockton's Putt to Win. He's never been to Australia either, never even come close. No matter, he told me. In order to see the country, you have to see the countryside, and you've only been to Sydney. And Melbourne, and Brisbane, I said. And I have too gone into the country, like hell you have. All right, I said, let's get Hugh on the phone. He'll tell you. He'll even send you pictures. Joan and her family live in Binghamton, New York. They don't see my father and me that often, so it was pretty lousy to sit at their table, he and I bickering like an old married couple. Ashamed by the bad impression we were making, I dropped the countryside business, and as my dad moved on to other people's shortcomings, I thought back to the previous summer and my 23-hour flight from London to Sydney. I was in Australia for a book tour because someone else was paying for the ticket, and it would be possible to stop in Japan on our way home. Hugh joined me. This is not to put Australia down, but he'd already gone once before. Then, too, spend that much time on a plane, and you're entitled to a whole new world when you step off at the other end. The planet Mercury, say, or, at the very least, Mexico City. For an American, though, Australia seems pretty familiar. Same wide streets, same office towers. It's Canada in a thong.